In order on March 4th, 2002. For the record, we have present Representative Berkowitz, Meyer, Coghill, and Rookberg. We have a quorum to do business.
Here, so just keep.
Mr. Feldman's done?
He's not online yet.
Okay. So. Yeah, I'm going to check on today's calendar. We have governor's appointment to the Commission on Judicial Council, the Board of Governors of Alaska Bar Association, and the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and HB 252, Standard of Care for China Services. First, I'd like to take up the appointment of Mr. Jeff Feldman to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, if in fact he's online. Mr. Feldman, are you online? You're not online. Then I'd like to move on to, we'll hold that in abeyance for a moment, and move on to Mr. William Granger. Mr. Granger, are you online, sir?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee, and thank you very much for taking the time today. Also, if you'd like to just give us a little brief description about who you are and what you perceive to be your role as a on the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, we'd appreciate it. And I take it this is a new appointment, and you have not served on the Board of Governors before. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Go ahead and tell us just a little bit about yourself and what you think will happen there.
Well, I am a lifelong Alaskan, raised and educated here. I've been a banker all of my adult life, most recently employed with NBA Wells Fargo. Currently in private practice making small consumer and larger commercial loans. I've been active in the Anchorage bar community in commercial type transactions and bankruptcy transactions for many years, and have had friends and acquaintances who have served on the Board of Governors over the years and have received from them glowing recommendations as to its educational process and its importance in maintaining the integrity and quality of the bar at large. And have always been interested in seeing that that would be kept to the highest standard possible. I have been active on the Board of Governors now for the last perhaps 6 months or so. Two or three of the regular meetings they've had, and been involved in their in some disciplinary matters as well as continuing education type matters and planning for the Bar Association meetings and that type of thing. So I'm starting to become a little familiar with what it is they do and how and why, and since my enthusiasm for that has not waned at all. Be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Granger. And is there any questions of Mr. Granger? Well, thank you very much, sir. I want to thank you for volunteering to serve the public of the state of Alaska. By most people that serve on various boards and commissions don't get a pat on the back, and we as elected public officials can understand that and have a lot of empathy. So I want to thank you very much for serving your fellow citizens here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Granger.
Have a nice day.
I have a sign-out sheet, which for the purposes of the committee, let's see. Maybe this is a new kind of a sheet.
Yep, because you guys asked for that last year.
Oh, we did.
You wanted the ability to put no rec on.
It says confirmed, not confirmed. Before, we just reported them out. That's interesting.
I am looking at you.
I didn't create.
In the past, it's been a no action. We're just reporting.
Do we have any of the old forms left?
Yeah, I like the old forms.
I can create a form really fast for you guys if you want. You can just send it to them if you want. I don't think it really matters.
Let's continue with the hearing at this point. Is Mr. Feldman on as yet? No.
Call him.
He's having trouble. He's in a. Yeah. Next, we'd like to go to take up the appointment to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Leslie Bogda Wheeler in Wasilla. Ms. Wheeler, are you there, ma'am?
Yes, I am.
Very good. If you could, you're a reappointment to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Is that correct, ma'am?
That is correct. I've served on the board for, I completed one person's term, and this will be my second full term. This appointment would be.
Why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself and your activities on the board, ma'am?
Okay. Well, myself, I'm a stay-at-home spouse. In the past, I worked on with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault for, I don't mean on the council, but in a program funded by the council for 8.5 years at Valley Women's Resource Center. Prior to that, I had worked for AWAKE. I devoted much of my professional life for the last 20 years to victim services and victim issues. Serving on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board has been a very rewarding experience for me because the board addresses the needs and issues of victims in many different circumstances, in addition to sexual assault and domestic violence and child sexual abuse. We also address the needs of victims of assaults and armed robberies and just the entire spectrum of victim compensation. I've been fortunate as a member of the board to attend a national conference on victim issues, which has broadened my knowledge considerably with the unfortunate advent of terrorism in our country. I was glad to know that we had already addressed some of the issues involved there so that we would be prepared in Alaska to provide those services. Our policies reflect those concerns and that preparation. I'd be happy to answer some questions. I hate to just go on and on and on. The board does quite a bit of work. We meet 4 times a year. The staff has done an incredible job of making sure that victims throughout Alaska receive benefit of compensation for out-of-pocket expenses. And I think the board is doing a very important job for people of Alaska. And I'm proud to serve on it and would enjoy continue serving on it.
Thank you. Is there any questions of Ms. Wheeler? Ms. Wheeler, what could you give us the committee an example of, say, the highest and the lowest amounts of compensation and what circumstances the board is made in your experience?
Would award those? Well, probably the lowest financial figure would be, say, somebody just had some expenses related to going to a hospital or perhaps out-of-pocket expenses for, I'm trying to think of something really small, maybe some crisis counseling for, say, 6 sessions. That would probably be anywhere. The smallest is a few $100s. The most expensive cases are those where somebody has been tragically injured and their medical bills go far beyond anything that we even have the resources to compensate. I believe our current amount for an individual is $25,000. In a multiple victim family or situation, we could award up to $40,000 for expenses that may in fact be into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. For a child that has lost their parent due to a violent crime, we would be able to provide $25,000 total to them, which, if you think about a child and the cost of raising a child, it's pretty much a drop in the bucket. Those are the opposite ends of the continuum, if you will, in terms of what we are able to award.
Right. And when you make those awards, do you look at whether there was insurance and also other family assets or net worth?
Yes, absolutely. We are a payer of last resort, so, or the Violent Crimes Compensation Board is the payer of last resort, and so all other ability to pay avenues are exhausted before the board pays anything. Not necessarily before we make a payment, but before we pay on any given claim or claim aspect.
Very good. Any other questions of Ms. Wheeler? Chair recognizes the attendance of Representatives Kukesh and James. Well, Ms. Wheeler, thank you very much, and we'd like once again to thank you very much for serving on this board. You don't get a pat on the back always, but we certainly appreciate your service and your continued service on the board. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome. Thank you very much.
All right. We are going to be circulating a sign-off sheet on Ms. Wheeler. Next, I'd like to ask if Mr. Feldman is with us.
I'm on the phone, yes.
Oh, very good. Right, Mr. Jeffrey Feldman is nominated for a reappointment to the Commission on Judicial Counsel. Mr. Feldman, if you might take a moment to explain who you are and your activities under Judicial Counsel as you perceive them.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Feldman, and I've been proposed for reappointment to the Commission on Judicial Conduct. As I'm sure you all know, the Commission on Judicial Conduct is responsible for enforcing the Code of Judicial Ethics and making recommendations to the Supreme Court for discipline of judges who are found to have violated that code. I'm a lawyer in private practice. I have resided in Alaska since 1975. I have a practice that is predominantly a trial and appeal practice, a mixture of civil and criminal caseload. And I've served on the, I can't even recall how long I've served on the Conduct Commission for. I think this is my third term, so probably I've been on the Conduct Commission for 6 years or thereabouts. The Commission, I think, fulfills an absolutely essential role in the judicial system by ensuring the integrity of the process. And the Conduct Commission receives a large number of grievances and complaints each year. Staff reviews those complaints, and I've had the pleasure of serving on the Conduct Commission with the mixture of judges and lay individuals who serve on the commission. And the commission does its best to review those complaints, hold hearings where appropriate, and make appropriate recommendations and findings. I think it's time that I've been on the commission. Work of the commission has been carried out in a more timely and I think more effective manner than historically was true. The caseload is much more current than once was true. And I think we're doing a better job responding to citizens' complaints and concerns on a timely basis. Having said that, there's also always a tension between rules that keep certain matters at certain stages of the investigation confidential and the desirability of having an open process that is available to the public. We operate under rules that are established both internally and by statute, and we've attempted to strike that balance. I think the judicial development in Alaska currently has one of the most open systems of judicial discipline in the country, which I have to personally think is highly desirable. And if it were up to me personally, I'd probably be happy to make it even more open.
Right. Any questions, Ms. Feldman? Mr. Feldman, could you tell a committee what a typical complaint that you would receive, or what's most typical that the committee feels strong enough to take up for official active action?
Well, the typical complaint is usually a complaint that's not within the jurisdiction of the commission. Typical complaint is received by a prisoner in jail or sometimes a dissatisfied litigant frequently in a defense. domestic matter has a disagreement with the decision that's been made by the judge. And I don't want to be disrespectful and say that these are disgruntled litigants, but unhappy litigants certainly account for a lot of complaints the commission receives, and we don't have the authority or jurisdiction, obviously, to review the correctness of a judge's decision in any case. But of the complaints that we receive that are within the commission's jurisdiction, I would say a significant number of those fall in the realm of what I would call judicial demeanor, that is to say, how judges behave and treat people. And the cases that we've had that have prompted actual imposition of discipline have been instances in recent years of judges crossing the line and engaging in actions that are beyond the scope of their authority, using the judicial power in a way that is found to be improper, and generally conducting themselves in a way that is consistent with the canons of judicial ethics. Some of those cases have been, for example, a judge who appointed someone into a coroner position and was found to have bypassed the normal procedures for doing that. We had a judge who recommended discipline last year for having to use the contempt power in a way that the commission concluded was improper. So demeanor and use of power, I suppose, are the two general categories that have tended to get judges in trouble. But I will say that it's always been a source of some, I suppose, pride and relief to me that we don't get very many complaints that I would regard as serious complaints of judicial misconduct. Most of the complaints we get are, like I said, unhappy litigants who don't like what happened to them in the process.
Let's see, Mr. Feldman, you might refresh my memory. Is it the judicial council that deals with the grading for retention, or does your commission have anything to do with the retention hearing?
We don't. There are two bodies that are frequently confused by not only the public, but by sometimes lawyers as well. There's the Alaska Judicial Council, which is responsible for retention issues and for screening applicants for appointments to the bench. And then there's the Commission on Judicial Conduct, on which I serve, and our mission is solely limited to judicial discipline.
Well, is there any communication between the two regarding retention, though?
Well, there is, in the sense that there is a rule that requires that if a judge is up for retention and is currently the subject of a conduct commission proceeding, certain notification of that proceeding has to be made to the council so that they can evaluate it, determine whether it bears on the judge's fitness for retention.
Very good. Any further questions, Mr. Feldman? Mr. Feldman, thank you very much for taking your time today and for your public service.
Well, thanks. I can tell you that I've always considered it an honor to serve, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll circulate Mr. Feldman's.
In the interest of full disclosure, I know Mr. Feldman, and please don't hold that against him.
I believe I've met the gentleman, and myself, he's well regarded in the bar and Anchorage. Charges too much, though.
So. Apparently not for his clients.
With that, we will. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on any of these three candidates for governmental appointment?
Good. Motion
no.
Okay.
I don't think so. These are reports, and I don't think we need a motion to report them out. That's a good question. Let's see.
I think we have.
Oh, that's right. I know there is a motion. Is there any objections to moving the recommendations on Jeffrey M. Feldman for the Commission on Judicial Counsel? Now, seeing none, we will forward that recommendation. Is there any objection to forwarding the nomination of William Granger to the Board of Governors for the Alaska Bar? Seeing none, so ordered. Is there any objections to the reappointment of Leslie Wheeler to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board? Seeing none, so ordered. And just in case we had to do the peremptory thing, I think that's right. We've accomplished that. So we now get to move on to House Bill 252, Standard Care for China Services. And I would like to mention to any of the witnesses or the people we before us that fundamentally I'd like to contain most of the discussion in here on legal issues, which really appertain to the civil liability section of Section 7 of the bill before us. But I would like to be familiarized with the bill on the presentation of the sponsor of the bill, so we have an idea of what we have here, if there's anything else we want to take up. But I would appreciate a more focused type of a testimony today. And with that, we'd ask that the sponsor of the bill, Representative Coghill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 252 does three major things. It includes a greater participation and a recognition of a parental right with regard to children in need of aid discussions. It establishes a pilot program with regard to intensive family services, which Representative Cisna has been more involved in than I have, and I have. She's here today to answer questions on that. Secondly, it goes to this Section 7 that you mentioned and talks about the duty and standard of care being exempted from this whole 4710 section, which I actually began the whole discussion. The reason I brought this whole bill forward was I wanted a little higher degree of accountability in the department under 4710. And when I saw that particular language in the statutes, I thought, this can't be. So what I went to is I went to find out what the standard and duty of care is. I find that they actually have, pretty good levels of care, but I wanted to tie it to statutes. After about a 50-page bill, I decided maybe I wouldn't go down the road of actually putting it all in statutes. So in the process of discussion, the need is still there. The best thing I could do without pushing the department, and the push would come from the balance between having a liability and having resource problems. And I would like to at least keep the accountability there, recognizing that we have resource issues that we have to deal with. And I didn't want to push the envelope so far that we required more of them than they could physically do. So I backed off of that, and I just said, okay, I think at least the civil liability should be there. They're dealing with issues, in my view, that are very powerful. For example, we've, under the 4710, the Child in Need of Aid laws, we give our department kind of quasi-police and judicial powers. They get to act on their judgment. And much like we do with the police force, whether it's Miranda rights or whatever we do to hold them accountable, I want to make sure that once we give them that power, that there's an accountability factor. So I've been trying to reach the language that'll help me get there. That's what I've been trying to do. And by taking that language out, certainly it catapulted this discussion to the Judiciary Committee. It was being discussed in the HES Committee, and we felt that we didn't really have the overview enough, so I asked for a judiciary committee hearing on the civil liability issue. The language that we see in the bill right now was brought forward by the Department of Law as a suggestion. They brought two, and I chose this of the two. They're here today. They can help answer the rationale for it. Personally, I would rather just take that out and let the liability be a little more open. But taking the statutes as we see now, it says that Nothing in this title creates a duty or standard of care for services to children under their families being served under AS 4710, which to me is just way too broad. So if we take that out of there, the broader approach is if there is need for recourse, then at least somebody reading the statute is not going to say, well, you can't do this. On the other hand, I don't want to throttle back the division from really asserting authority under 4710 that it needs to in cases where there is danger and harm. So I'm trying to find that balance of, okay, we've got the power and they need to be accountable for using it, but we don't want to throttle it back to being used. So that was the whole intention of this bill, to give families a greater portion of not only the definition of their or respecting their parental authority, so to speak, and give them inclusion in once they're involved in a 4710 child in need of aid, but then this family preservation service, and then the civil liability issue, which says, to me, there is no standard and duty of care, which I object to. So that's really the layman's language of it, and I ask for this committee hearing so that we can consider Section 7. I have an amendment here that I will propose after we've had the discussion on Section 7. And then I have one amendment to do some cleanup language that was suggested. It's just technical in nature. So I wouldn't do anything more substantive than that in this committee. But I think the legal question is substantive. So if you look at the language in the brackets on page 5 of this bill, you'll see that it says duty and standard of care is a heading. It says nothing in this title creates a duty or standard of care for services to children and their families being served under AS 4710, which is the whole child in need of aid statute. I would rather take that out of there. And as I say, this language that's now in the CS that we have before us, if you'll adopt CS for House Bill 252P, which I think has been noticed, that, sir, is the short introduction.
Questions of the sponsor? Mr. Cogg, let me understand the goal of this legislation is to establish in law the fact that the department has a duty or standard of care of the children underneath them, because there are standards and duties specified in law or regulation, and it's a matter of policy or practice.
As a matter of fact,
but then you still want to retain some type of sovereign immunity here, where it exculpates those people from any civil liability. So is that basically the thrust here, or what?
Well, that's the language I put in here that the Department of Law brought forward. My rathers would be to have it taken out entirely, because I think that anybody has the right to charge under civil liability at this point anyway. So if they felt that there was harm done, I don't want to have language in the statute that specifically exempts this department. When this was first put in under House Bill 375, I think it was several years ago, there were so many new provisions in here, and they didn't know exactly how they would put them into regulation. There was some fear that they would be open to suits before they could actually get it kind of installed up and running. And we had that discussion in the HES committee, and at the danger of misrepresenting it, they wanted some cover from that, and it may be even go beyond that. But at least from my point of view, it's come to be. We have had this law in. It's hit the ground running. Sometimes they do an excellent job. I think there are times when people overstep their bounds. Families themselves, under these 4710 laws, can be held to a very high degree of accountability. And really, sometimes, in my view, is a very subjective judgment. Based on that, police power, judicial power that is kind of handed off to this agency, I think it's important that parents have some recourse. Now, there are many court proceedings and timelines and all these other things and duties and standards that are in policy right now. And I would rather have put them a little more specifically in statutes. I don't think we can get there this year, and I don't want to push to the point where we become so ineffective under law that everything collapses. So the intention at this point is just to say, right now, I want to make sure that at least we're not exempting ourselves from a standard of care, which this statute says. So their policy at this point becomes a little more critical. And I think that under the statute scheme that we have now, it treads on thin ice, in my view. So given the authority to the division and exempting recourse from individuals, I think is unwise. I mean, that's a layman's point of view.
President Berkowitz.
I'm just kind of curious, are there any suits at this time, and what's the state's potential liability?
Well, we have the Department of Law here that might be able to more specifically answer that.
There is someone else. I will bring Ms. Cox up, but there's another individual in Fairbanks who wanted to testify. You want to hold that in abeyance?
At your pleasure. Yes.
Okay. Then we'll go to the Fairbanks LIO. I'd like to hear from Mr. Scott Calder. If you give us your name and affiliation, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible that we could hear from the Department of Law before I give my remarks?
Well, if you like.
I don't mind. I have till 3 o'clock. It might be interesting to see what they say.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. I'll be right here.
Does anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 252? Ms. Cox. Representative Berkowitz. Oh. She's here to answer questions, right?
My name is Susan Cox. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent the state in personal injury litigation specifically. I do not do children's cases myself. Through the chair to answer Representative Berkowitz's question. Yes, we do have cases pending now. Some have been related to events that occurred before the legislation, the Smart Start legislation that passed, was enacted 4 years ago, and some that are more recent. The standard for liability is essentially that the Division of Family and Youth Services has failed to exercise reasonable care in protecting children from harm. And those could be children in foster care who are not protected adequately from foster parents or others in the foster home, or children who are not taken into foster care and protected from their natural parents. We have, unfortunately, cases of both kinds that the special litigation attorneys, primarily in the Attorney General's office, handle. The section that is at issue here today, which is Section 7 of this current CS, was included in the legislation 4 years ago, essentially, as the legislative history would reveal, to preserve the status quo with respect to liability. This language that says that it does not create a duty or standard of care did not create an immunity, did not immunize the department. The intention was to keep individual provisions selectively or collectively from creating in and of themselves, or at least from foreclosing the argument that individual provisions created new causes of action or new theories for liability. Obviously, it certainly left open the argument that the department or the division has failed, has been negligent in failing to protect children from harm. And so this was an attempt just to keep specific provisions of the China laws from becoming themselves vehicles for new tort theories, new causes of action. as I said, both before and since this statute was enacted, we have had litigation, and unfortunately we still do. One of the main concerns at the time was specifically with respect to timelines. The legislation in Title 47 regarding children in need of aid set very specific goals. In fact, Representative Dyson has told me that he considers them goals and guidelines, and expects the division to exercise some flexibility in moving to terminate parental rights and in making permanent decisions with respect to children. And both because of the resource questions with respect to needing enough social workers to handle things in the most beneficial manner, and because the courts can't always do everything in the timelines required, we do not want to see failure to act within certain time frames to become themselves a basis for new tort theories. Again, we always have the potential for a negligence action claiming that the division or the department or a specific social worker has failed to protect children adequately. So this is the language here about not creating a duty or standard of care was something that Representative Dyson, as one of the architects of the Smart Start legislation, agreed to, and it was part of the overall package, and it was factored into the fiscal note in 1998. It is a term of art. It is certainly not intended to imply to anyone that the Division of Family and Youth Services does not need to have standards in how they care for children or how they protect children. In fact, that's certainly not the case. In reviewing Title 47, I think the process, the whole system makes clear that both the division, the courts, guardians ad litem, and families all have responsibilities in ensuring that the system works to the benefit of the children. There is also there is accountability both in that process, in that parents who are aggrieved have the ability to be represented by counsel, to advocate on their own behalves, to get court-appointed counsel if they cannot afford it. Guardians ad litem are appointed to represent children's interests, and there are voluminous policies and procedures that the division has, and also administrative complaint processes that are in place if parents or others involved in the system aren't happy with how something's gone. But there are many instances in the statutes where if someone's not satisfied, they can go to court and ask the judge to review the situation if they're not satisfied. The problem that I pointed out at the HES committee was, but if 4710960 was to be repealed in its entirety, it begs the question what the legislature's intent is in doing that. Is it the legislature's desire to open the door for new arguments about liability based on the China laws? Is that the intent, or is it just that the words that are in the statute are offensive or somehow misleading to the lay public? Unfortunately, as a defense attorney, I think it wouldn't take long to envision new suits or new theories raised in existing suits that if this language were repealed, that some provision in the China law, if not followed to a T, are not satisfied as far as a parent or another involved person was concerned, would become a new theory of liability, and the Attorney General's office would end up certainly arguing whether it was this body's intention to create new liabilities. So we suggested some alternative language that did not speak in terms of standard of care, since it was our understanding that saying there is no standard of care was the problem, and the language you see before you in the current CS is one of the suggestions we made. That was the suggestion that the House HES Committee chose to insert in their committee substitute. And there's certainly other ways it could be said, but if the section 4710960 is repealed altogether without some substitute language, I think we will expect to experience a fiscal impact in my office. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of Ms. Cox?
Great.
Representative Berkowitz.
So I'm clear. The under the existing statute, suits have been initiated, so people who feel that that the department has wronged them have access to the courts.
That is true primarily in the area of people who believe that children have been harmed, either from being placed in foster care that was not appropriate, not safe, or not being placed in foster care at all. At this point, the parents who do not like the way the process is handled things do not necessarily have a right of recourse for themselves. The suits that we have maintain that they're that the children have been negligently harmed as a result of the division or the department's actions. So I would not say that we have ongoing litigation involving parents' allegations that they've been somehow aggrieved. It pertains to failing to protect children.
If I could, we'll follow up. Indicated that the existing language was a result of discussions with Representative Dyson when the HB 375 went through.
That's correct.
Prior to HB 375's enactment, what was the standard?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, prior to the enactment of the 375 4 years ago, I don't believe there was anything along these lines, but the laws in Title 47 relating to child protection were not as, if I may suggest, mandatory, or they were not as extensive and did not impose as many obligations on the department, at least in statute.
Thank you.
First of all, to even though Representative Dyson might have voted for it, I don't know that he would, according to some of his testimony in the last committee of referral, that this was he was totally in agreement with this particular language, so, you know, for what it's worth. Parents don't have a lot of latitude on timelines. They're held civilly liable right now if they don't make a court date. Parents are civilly liable if they don't follow through even suggestions. Certainly parents are held civilly liable if they sign something that they don't necessarily understand and can't comply with because they have not been properly instructed. Parents are held civilly liable if they have their children taken away from them. Parents have many people from courts, from DFYS, from a variety of different places holding them civilly liable for actions that they don't totally understand in law. And I'm saying that with all the laws that our department understands and all the authority that they're given and all the things that they are instructed in continually should be at least liable for not following those timelines. So I think the timeline argument is not a very good argument. I also understand that litigation is very difficult for a parent who is actually under investigation. But, the intent of this, in my view, is to bring that liability at least to some equity. And so if we need an intent, I think that's part of it. But the new liabilities you were talking about, what would you envision as a new liability should we take this out?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I think one thing needs clarifying. First of all, saying that someone is civilly liable means that they are subject to a judgment for damages in the litigation world, and that's what we're talking about here with the Section 7. To say that a parent is held accountable, as you've suggested in many instances, in the DFYS and China system, is not the same thing as saying that they are civilly liable.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask a question.
Please.
It is a civil action, though.
A China case is a civil action. It's a children's action. It has a special kind of...
It is a civil action.
Yes, certainly. But there is a difference between saying civil liability for purposes of damages and saying that someone is responsible for following certain processes in the law and the statutes that are there that say that the parents are to comply with various things that are required by the courts or DFYS if the China statutes are invoked and a process is initiated are different than saying that the parents are civilly liable. It's just a point of clarification.
Well, yeah, and we, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and Mr. Chairman, the effect is significant, though, when you're bringing this kind of civil action. And I understand the difference between civil liability as far as dollars and cents go or other court action, but it's all still under civil action.
Yes, and if I may, the responsibilities of the department are spelled out in the same statutes that speak to the responsibilities of parents. The court oversees the process, and the recourse is there currently with the courts. As far as your question about new liabilities, I guess by removing this language that has up to this point meant that the China statutes in and of themselves do not create new causes of action, or at least eliminates that argument, by repealing that, it opens the door to the argument that, in fact, each provision of Title 47 or 4710 in itself, if it's not followed, could create a statutory cause of action for damages. Now, that's not necessarily going to be the conclusion reached by the court, but it's certainly going to be the argument made, and begs the question, what is the legislature's intent in removing that language? Was it to open the door to additional types of liability? So virtually any provision in 4710, if it wasn't followed to a parent's or a guardian ad litem satisfaction, would be arguably the basis for a civil suit for damages, apart from the interplay that we already expect under the China laws in the court process in the China case itself.
I would respectfully submit then we should probably put this at the conclusion of almost every set of laws we make.
Sharon, did you want to join us up here? The chair recognizes the presence of Representative Sisna here. Scott, you can sit.
Oh. Would you like me to?
No, you can stay there.
Right. I always need help.
I was to invite you to the table, not the witness chair, unless you wanted to.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, did you want to say something?
You've asked it.
Oh, I see. If you wanted to come up here and join us.
Oh, John. Oh, okay. I was
I'm not going to put you. We're going to put you on the hot seat.
Does that mean that I get to speak?
Certainly it does.
Mr. Chairman, the
Representative Coghill.
You know, I guess I'm getting a little wrapped for services to children and their families being served, and that's offensive to me. As far as what we're trying to do in our statutes, and that is, we're trying to protect children. And we're specifically saying that we're not creating anything that causes us to be responsible. So that's why I brought this to this particular committee, because if I am so wrong that I can't understand plain English, and if there's technical reasons for having that language in there, I just want to hear it, and I want it on the record.
Mr. Chairman?
Wait a minute. Do you want to respond to that, Ms. Cox?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, only to say that the term, does not create a duty or standard of care, as I pointed out, is a term of art in civil liability, and the intention was to maintain the status quo. Liability is still possible. This does not create an immunity, and it was part of the whole package that was enacted 4 years ago, based on a comprehensive redo of the statutes.
All right, Representative Meyer, then work with.
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the sponsor and his comment here that he wants to hold the department to the same level that we hold parents, and I don't disagree with that. I think that's the way it should be. I'm just wondering if you really feel that by putting the civil liability on them, that it's going to change anything that's currently going on. In fact, it may just add more expense, but I'd like to get your feelings on that.
Well, first of all, I think if we take the language out, then all we're doing is creating the what-if question. We're really not creating a greater liability. And there's been the testimony before us, this could change it, and there could be other litigation, and there's a what-if factor that I think that that is just that, it's a what-if factor. So, but if you leave the plain language in the statute, then there's a lot of what-if taken away from parents, because we're saying that there's nothing in this title that creates a duty or standard of care for services to children or their families. And that's very explicit language.
Well, unfortunately, a term of art language sometimes confuses the common meaning for words, and but I appreciate your point, Representative Berkowitz.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Getting somewhat used to staring at gaps, I'm getting a little bit more joy at bridging them. I think what I'm hearing Representative Coghill say is he wants some affirmative statement that a duty or standard of care exists. And what I'm hearing the department say is that they would prefer that it arise under some different provision of law than 4710. Is that accurate? Or that it does arise under some different...
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, we would be perfectly content, not happy, but perfectly satisfied to have liability remain a question of the common law, breach of reasonable care, the standard negligence test, and not be a question of statutory causes of action, or at least arguably statutorily created causes of action.
Is that an accurate? You want some affirmative statement that...
I think, thank you, Representative Berkowitz. I think that's where I'm heading. I want to try to get something that'll help us bridge this very gap.
Well, if I could, then wouldn't something along the lines of, and I'm sure that people can wordsmith this a little bit, but something that goes along the lines of the duty or standard of care for services to children and their families being served, that's would satisfy Representative Coghill's concern, does not arise under AS 4710 or arises from the common law, but if you could have some kind of language like that, would that seem to bridge the gap?
Did you, Representative Coghill, did you consider just omitting this whole section?
Yes. In fact, I think the omission says primarily what where Representative Berkowitz is going, because it would be, I think it would be assumed anyway.
But I think if I could just have a little colloquy here, that you wanted a statement that there is an affirmative duty or standard of care, and if you assert that there is a duty or standard of care, or at the same time acknowledging that it does arise out of the common law, but instead of saying it arises out of the common law, just say it doesn't arise under 4710 or arises.
Ms. Cox, could you explain to the committee the difference between a common law cause of action for civil liability versus a statutory cause of action?
Yes, Chairman Roper. The common law test for negligence, the elements are the existence of a duty, the breach of a duty. Typically, the duty is one to act with reasonable care, and so there's a duty of reasonable care. The breach of that, failure to exercise reasonable care, causation, it causes damages to the injured person. And that is the test of negligence in this state. It's not spelled out in a statute anywhere. But the question is then whether there has been essentially negligence in either the action toward, in this case, a particular child, or the failure to act to protect a child from harm, and that is the law in Alaska, but is not a creature of a statute. A statutory cause of action can be implied by the courts if they view the legislature's intent to create a cause of action for damages flowing directly from a statute. So the argument becomes, did the legislature's enactment of a particular law create a specific duty that substitutes for the general test for negligence. Is that the legislature's intention, to create specific liabilities flowing from the statute itself rather than a statutory scheme to accomplish certain things? That ordinarily, this kind of language that we have in 4710960 does not need to be said, because it is not presumed that the legislature, in regulating all manner of legal situations in the state, intends to create liabilities. In House Bill 375, this language was included because of the concern that the legislation was getting so specific, and the argument could be raised that the legislature was intending to create mandatory duties, the breach of which would in and of themselves create new liabilities. So this specific sentence in 4710960 was included to prevent that argument from being raised. The problem that we have from seeing it repealed is the question of construction by the courts subsequently, because now that it's on the books, the repeal of it begs the question, what is the legislature's intent again? Now are we going back to the scenario where the legislature possibly did presume to create new liabilities with its specific mandates in 4710? And if this had never been said, maybe we wouldn't be having this discussion. But since it has been said, the idea of repealing it raises the question of what the intent is. That, frankly, I guess the substitute language that you see in this committee substitute from the Hess Committee was an attempt to remove the language that Representative Coghill does find so offensive, that which says there is no duty or standard of care, but to still leave the playing field the same as we've had it.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Berkowitz.
So, in essence, the duty or standard of care that exists currently derives from the common law, is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Berkowitz.
Why don't we just say that?
Would that be okay?
I thought by repealing it, that's what we were saying.
Let's just say it out there. So the duty or standard of care for services to children and their families being served derived from the common law, period.
I'm sure open to that suggestion.
Through the chair, if I get to react, that would certainly
Please,
be fine with me. I mean, and again, I think it's only because we've said that it doesn't create a duty that I think it's helpful to say that it derives from the common law, and that in itself keeps us on the same playing field we've been on.
Right, I was thinking along kind of the same lines, because I was looking first at repealing the entire section, which was default back to that situation, but then Ms. Cox's testimony with the questioning of the courts of the legislative intent, you know, creates a hole. So that would be the way to actually fill it there.
I've noticed sometimes that we're redundant in order to repeat ourselves over and over again sometimes.
We are very redundant. Is that a pun?
Puns are the highest form of humor, Mr. Chair. They're the only form of humor that doesn't make fun of anybody.
Did you get that written down, Reneva?
I
think
it's one more time.
The duty or standard of care for services to children and their families being served, that or the bit about puns, which did you want? their families being served derives from the common law, period.
But that would be applicable to, we have the drafting here is interesting because it includes the entire title, which is the entire health, education, and welfare title.
It's a
chapter. Or a chapter. Well, that's a chapter. I mean, was there, Ms. Cox, can you, you did speak earlier about your concerns that anything in the entire title could be construed to be underneath this, but then, I mean, on the one hand, we're talking about the title, and on the other hand, we're talking about the chapter here, so.
Chairman Roekberg, I think perhaps the reason for referring to the title at the beginning of the sentence in 4710960 was because HB 375 did make amendments throughout 47, Title 47, not limited to 4710. There were a number of changes made in 4705 and elsewhere, and so that may be the reason that sentence is so broad. I think, however, if the language suggested by Representative Berkowitz were adopted, I would not anticipate having problems from the change to the section elsewhere in Title 47.
Well, it troubles me a little bit because I appreciate your answer, though. That explains a lot of it, but I think it's a bad way to draft. I don't know. Unless
you put an under 4710.
Well, that's why I leave that. I mean, one or the other, you know. But you shouldn't have both in there. But also, the other thing, we're creating by a statutory statement the applicability of common law. Would that apply both just to the department, or would it apply to a foster parent or anybody that was deemed to have responsibility under the statute?
Chairman Roquart, I believe it would apply to anybody who is affected by Title 47 and in terms of their responsibilities within the statutes.
47 or 4710?
Well, this is in 4710, so if it remains 4710-960, presumably it would apply to 4710.
President Calhoun.
To follow up on your question, wouldn't that be the case anyway under 4710 with regard to liability under common law?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Whether it be foster parents or the department, there would still be some cause of action, or at least recourse for some action under common law right now, wouldn't there be?
That's what she's saying. Right. Yeah. There is. That's basically the standards.
Right. And so by saying it, what have we changed?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, what we've changed is the argument that by taking out this express statement that the statutes don't create a duty, by removing that, you are raising the specter that the question of whether the legislature now intends the statutes to become bases for liability in themselves. You're removing that argument and saying, no, we're...
I appreciate that. And one of the things that I tried to do under this was to create a standard of duty and care, which I said became so long and so difficult that I just scrapped that whole idea in discussion with the department, that their policy right now is what they're leaning on, and we have gaps where they can't even fulfill it because of time pressure, caseloads, and workforce issues. So, I mean, I didn't want to create such an egregious problem there that we tilt it either. So, I think I'm beginning to understand.
Any other comments or questions? I see we got rid of the heading on the section. You took out duty of and standard of care and replaced it with civil liability not created.
Chairman Roquart, the heading had been duty and standard of care not created, and so obviously in this revision we were substituting civil liability for the words duty and standard.
Well, we need another heading.
Well,
about duty and standard of care, period.
Period.
Seems to be an agreement on it. Well, and that defaults back to the current statute.
Then, Mr. Chairman, then at that point, then I would move that heading as well as the language that Representative Berkowitz suggested, and that is duty and standard of care.
Period.
And then the duty and standard of care for services to children and their families being served under AS 4710 is derived from common law, period.
Okay. Did you make that motion?
Yes, I'll make
that. I'll object for a person's discussion. Ms. Cox. Right. Hold one, Ms. Cox. Ms. Cox, do you think we should have the entire title there or limited to the China chapter?
Chairman Rookwood, I think that would be adequate as suggested. I mean,
the common law covers the whole title.
Right, and it would presumably apply to the rest of Title 47,
right.
Too. So I guess as long as it's understood, and I think the legislative history of this committee hearing would make clear that the committee is not intending to create new liabilities anywhere at this point in Title 47. But to change the language here to reflect Representative Coghill's preferences for the wording.
Representative Coghill, it's your bill.
Just a question. So that, and that's one of the reasons I wanted this committee, because I couldn't figure my way out of this in trying to get to this exemption as I saw it. And I appreciate your testimony that it's
that's
not
a case
exemption.
Of getting too close to something. You couldn't see the forest for the trees. Or you forgot to wear your glasses. There you go.
On the other hand, are we not increasing any ability to exempt department from somebody saying you did it wrong and suing them at this point for a civil action?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. No, the language that we've been discussing, both the language on the table and your proposed amendment, as far as I'm concerned, I don't believe it creates any new exemption from liability, and it should not create any new liability. It is, again, another effort at maintaining the status quo with respect to legal theories available in the China world.
And, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Coghill.
In the China world, if you read some of these statutes, they can put you into a coma because of the way they're written.
Right.
It's very difficult. And I can tell you, just as a human being trying to understand this law, especially with regard to those who have been put under the force of this law, it can become a very difficult thing. And I think going to plain English is a much better way to go, so for what it's worth.
I always approve of that approach. I do remember House Bill 375 sitting in this very room.
As do I.
Yes. A sea change. Now we know where the captain and the crew is. Captain Dyson. Yeah, right. Anyway, we do have a motion on the floor.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Calder was...
I know, but we have a motion on the floor. So, and I objected to it based on... I still am not satisfied with AS... 47.10 vis-a-vis under this title. So
we took that out, though.
It's not there anymore.
Well, we did. I thought you read it. It said, yeah, he read it as AS
47.
Yeah.
Yeah, we took out the word title.
The title's not there.
No, I know, but I want to put it. Shouldn't it be there vis-a-vis the China chapter, is what I'm suggesting.
I thought that was...
That was, well, that's the my nature of my question.
Isn't that 4710 is the China chapter?
Okay. Right.
That's why I know, but the title is the whole Hess title.
It's all 47.
Right. So that's my question. If the common law applies the whole title, why don't we say that? Not just the China chapter.
Because this isn't the right section for that.
Huh?
Yeah, we're just in the China section. Don't be a bull in the China shop, Mr. Chair.
But it already says... In the current language, this title.
In this title. AS 4710.
Oh, okay. I'll withdraw my objection. Just to be sure we have it right. But for the record, then, it would be my assumption that, notwithstanding anything to the contrary, that the balance of the title would be covered by common law civil liability. Would that be your interpretation, Ms. Cox?
Chairman Rookwood, that would certainly be my understanding, assuming that that's still the intent of the legislature, and I would I don't know of any basis for anyone arguing otherwise.
Very good. Is there any objections to adopting the amendment, conceptual amendment number one?
Could you read it again first, Mr. Chairman, just to make
Representative
sure?
Representative Cox will be happy to.
The title would be Duty and Standard of Care. The text would be under 4710-960, the duty and standard of care for services to children and their families being served under AS 4710 is derived from common law, period.
Should be or.
Or.
The duty or standard of care.
Or standard of care?
Yes. Parallel structure.
Correct. The duty or standard of care for services to children and their families being served under AS 4710 is derived from common law, period.
Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. You can step right there. Mr. Calder, you want to come on now? And sorry, we may have. I hope you got what you wished for, that you're welcome to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had hoped that I might be able to testify before the committee took action, but I guess you're kind of in the middle of something there. And so I'll try to get to my remarks here. I have quite a bit to say about this bill. Thankfully, Representative Cogdill has said a lot of it already, but there still leaves a lot left. First of all, I'd like to debunk this notion that that parents whose children have been harmed by the department have some type of existing recourse or method of resolution. The existing specifications of recourse or method of resolution are additional modes of torture for parents already, and there really is, it's just a myth. The assumption that there's possible recourse is a myth. So a lot of the discussion has focused on kind of an assumption of a steady state of things being okay, or that there being possibilities for resolution. And this is a distinct falsehood, in my opinion, and I think that can be objectively shown if we ever have a situation in a venue where these grievances can be aired, which we do not now. The notion that parents have effective counsel is false. The notion that the child's best interests are guarded by the court officers is false. The notion that there is an administrative complaint process, which deserves that name or description, is false. And the idea that a person cannot, in practical terms, that a person can go to court to resolve difficulties or be represented in court, or I might add, in many cases, not all cases, be represented in the legislature, is false. There is several statements made by Ms. Cox regarding maintaining the status quo, leaving the playing field as we had it, assuming no state, no change in state practices in regard to expected fiscal notes and things like this. And Mr. Chairman, I have to tell you from personal experience as a witness to human rights crimes perpetrated under the color of law by this agency that you know, we should change the way things are right now. It's not just a little fix or a little problem in one little paragraph. Nothing has been said about the family preservation efforts contained in the remainder of the bill, and I can understand that the person might miss some of the language contained in those sections, and a person might not understand the consequences for families. But and we could go through line by line. I have a lot of notes here, and so I'd be happy to answer your questions about the specific suggestions. But let me just say generally that the problem here, again, is that placing the idea of family preservation services or eligibility for family preservation services, or really what amounts to mercy by an oppressor, to place that within the discretion of the department continuation of the problem. Now, I think that family preservation services could maybe be a good thing, but oftentimes the thing that needs to be done to preserve a family is to remove the state from the life of the children and the family members who have become ensnared. And simply assuming that, oh, well, they could go to court or they could complain or do something else, this just adds additional injury to already occurring injuries and insults. So, it's very difficult to break through this problem conceptually. I can understand that. But I think what we have to do is we have to realize as a society and as a state that we have a serious problem here that needs to be addressed. That it can't just be made to go away by some polite conversation about the technicalities of one particularly difficult section, such as Section 7, which was discussed. Sorry, I have about four pages of notes here. We have gone from, as Representative Coghill indicated, a simple idea of rebalancing things somewhat so that the parents at least would have some right or standing as an authoritative individual in the life of the child. We've gone from that to creating a burdensome presumption that parents are essentially irrelevant unless the department comes along and wants to process them based on some kind of state grant or license or permission to be preserved as a family. And this is absolutely ridiculous, but it's also typical of the thinking that goes into these legislative items, as near as I've been able to tell. I think that it's only appropriate to have the parental rights parental rights language contained in the construction section, for example, rather than the intent section. Now, I'm not an attorney. Maybe somebody could explain why it's better in the intent section. But it says on legislative intent, by the amendment of AS 4710.005, Section 206, the legislature intends to express its recognition that parents possess inherent individual rights, et cetera. All it says in that 4710.005 is that the department apparently can liberally construe the provisions of this chapter so that people may receive the care, guidance, treatment, or the child coming within the jurisdiction may receive the care, guidance, and treatment that will promote the child's welfare and the parent's participation in the child's upbringing. Mr. Chairman, we need to do something to correct the problem where the parent's authority to be responsible and to direct and control the education and upbringing of their own children is what we have in law. Not simply the department is at liberty to involve or decide what participation is or make any of these other types of judgments based on whatever the prerogatives of the department are. Now, there are many of us who understand that the activities of the department are motivated by a progressive understanding and a realization that the children do need to be protected and that there are very important social issues there. But what is consistently missed is the fact that while we say that, what we're doing is we're stripping parents of authority and stripping children of their parents and their families. The very support network that we say is important to children is consistently eroded by these laws that we have. And I guess just to kind of sum up,
please do, sir.
I'm not satisfied with this the amendment process of this bill. Now, I would defer to Representative Cockfield's judgment on it, but I would think that we would be dangerously close here to creating a worse problem than we already have. I'm not sure. I would hope that there would be some questions because I can certainly answer them. Maybe I'll just pause there and see if there are questions, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions, Mr. Colliger? Seeing none, sir. I guess I do have one question. Do you support this bill, or are you against it?
That is such a close call, sir. I absolutely supported the bill when it was first introduced. I think that creating additional things for the department to do and to say that it's doing which are not binding upon it in any meaningful way, is pointless. It's just a verbal exercise. It's apparently to create some visibility for the claim that that maybe something is being done about this problem. What we have is an institution that's involved in human rights crimes against the citizens, and I would hope that the legislature at least would recognize the standing of citizens with complaints, citizens of the state, to a higher degree than it does the attorneys of the state. This seems to be an attorney's document, not a document for humanity. Not knowing what common law is, or how to address that, I don't know if anything has been done with Section 7 today, other than maybe shuffling some words around.
No, Mr. Calder, I think your position has been enhanced by that amendment, so don't take it as a negative.
I do see that particular amendment may have improved that particular section. However, what I'm unable to determine is whether that outweighs the damage that's contained in the remainder of the amendments to the original HB 252.
Well, Mr. Calder, this is the Judiciary Committee, and we're really not going to be focusing on that today. So I want to thank you for your testimony and the time you spent on this and your devotion to the issue. And I do appreciate your concern about parents and their relationship with the department and making sure that the procedures are followed and that the parents have an ability to complain. And if you can't get it right, you can call Representative Coghill any day.
Yes, thank you. Right. Thank you, Scott, for your time.
Right. Thank
sir,
you.
If I may just say, the family preservation stuff, has the parents written in as guilty until proven innocent, that is a judicial issue, and that is the problem with the statutes, the other statutes that we have in place. And I would ask you to further consider that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Does anybody else wants to testify on House Bill 252? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 252. Representative Coghill.
I have one more amendment. I'll call it Amendment Number 2, and that all are cleanup amendments to page 5. If you go to page 5, line 25, after the word with and before the word intensive, the word the, we'll ask for that to be deleted. Page 5, line 27. The word should change to shall. Page 5, line 29, the word should change to shall. That's on recommendation from legal.
That's the memorandum in the packet of February 22nd.
No,
from Terry Lauterbach.
Yes, it is. Okay. Yes, I had two different legal opinions. So.
Right. That's the right basis for that.
Except for line 25, the word the, I think, came from Representative Berkowitz.
Well, give credit where credit's due. Is that your amendment?
That's the amendment.
Everybody understand the amendment? Is there any objections to amendment number 2? Conceptual amendment, yeah. Well, seeing none, so adopted. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 252 as amended? Representative Berkowitz.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. On page 2, line 1, they talk about child's welfare in the bill, but most of the time we talk about the best interests of the child. It seems to me to be preferable to make that a line instead of child's welfare, talk about the best interests of the child. They'd be promoting the best interests of the child.
You repeat that one more time.
Page 2, line 1.
After?
Instead of child's welfare, say best interest of the child.
Oh, promote the best interest of the child?
Right. And then...
Well, that's the whole point here. This is construction. It's supposed to be liberally construed, so would welfare be part of that?
No, we always, as I recall, HB 375, one of the big things we did was shift to the best interest of the child. And if we're interested in children, I think we need to be consistent with the use of that phrase. I mean, that's what we want people to, the course to focus on, is the best interest of the child, which might not be the same thing as the child's welfare. I don't know, but it might not be the same thing. But
I don't know either. I mean, Representative Cocchio, you got a comment on that?
I think because I'm adding parents' participation, I think it's appropriate language change, because I am including parents once they now come under court jurisdiction. I'm asking that parents be included in the participation.
Well, that,
and I think this would clarify that whole intent, that it's really for the child's best interest.
Right. And what I did was, because when you have best interest or welfare and parents' participation, you're telling the court to do two things. But if you say best interest, comma, including or featuring or focusing on parents' participation, then the court knows first thing they need to go to is the best interest, but that we want to figure prominently in the parental participation.
So you want including the parents instead of and the parents?
Yes. I mean, you're telling the court to do two things with and, which is opposed to doing a hierarchy of responsibility.
Excuse me, John, I thought we were talking about a child's welfare, and then you've expanded the whole
thing. Well, it's promote the best interest of the child, comma, including the parent's participation in the child.
What about those instances when the parent's participation is to be prohibited?
Well, that's why you want to give the right. Don't make it and, you want to make it comma including. So the court might say, we want to include the parents, oops, but it's not in the best interest of the child.
Right.
But if you say best interest of the child and parental participation, and it might not be a good thing to have the parent involved, the court's kind of stuck. So that's why I would do it best interest of the child, comma, including the parent's participation. You got to hit him.
Yeah.
I have to hit him. Mr. Chair, may I make a comment? Sometimes you're actually...
Representative Sisson.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Sometimes you're going to actually want to be including the parent and the child's life, but from a distance even.
Well, I understand.
You know, it's not...
Each case is different, right? Sometimes it's total exclusion, or sometimes partial, sometimes as inclusive as possible.
But as, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman, as it occurs now, more often the parent is excluded. It is leaning away from including the parent. For instance, when their child has been removed, custody removed even, it is possible other states are including the parent in the children's life even after the discontinuance of the parents.
Well, I'm sure I'm not an expert in this area, but I understand that one of the biggest problems now is the yo-yo effect of the prior parents that may not have given up their parental rights, having a foster child yo-yo in and out of that parent's life. So I don't know. Is that good or bad? You know, sometimes they're better off with their foster parents than they are with their biological parents.
That's
true, but this wouldn't change that in many ways.
Well, I hope not.
And I can appreciate the tension that was created in the sentence. And
wasn't that a natural tension?
It is a natural tension, and we call on judges quite often to make that. And I wanted to make sure that the parents' participation is a part of the equation. And I think including would probably still do that. It just wouldn't be as mandated. But it would also give a relief if the parents could not participate because of charges.
Well, will somebody repeat the amendment?
It would be page two would be promote the, and then insert best interests of the child, comma, including, and then delete child's welfare and.
Inserting this. Best interest of the child.
Which, Mr. Chairman, quite frankly, is the whole duty under AS 4710 is promoting child welfare.
Best interest.
Best interest, right. And I've been trying to just insert or assert the parents at a greater degree than we have previously, that's all.
Well, I wish the Captain Dyson was around here. He could bless this whole controversy one way or the other.
Well, I will make sure that he sees this language before
Please
we get
do.
To finance.
This conceptual amendment number three, then, is before the committee. Are there any objections to conceptual amendment number three? Seeing none, so adopted. Any further comments?
This is the committee. I would like to move the much amended House Bill 252 from Judiciary to Finance with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, and with the caveat that I will talk to the chairman of the HES committee on concurrence with some of these before we get to Finance Committee.
You don't want to move the House Bill.
Committee substitute, I'm sorry. I was corrected. It's committee substitute for House Bill 252 as amended, version P.
Attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections to moving this bill? Seeing none, so ordered. Thank you. The committee is now adjourned at approximately 2:43. Sign the book.